More migrant deaths at the Chrome Detention Center. Channel 10 divorces ABC and hails a new TV future here. And we observe a slew of city centennials like Jupiter's. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll examine new controversies, including two new deaths at the Federal Chrome Detention Center for migrants in Miami-Dade. Why do these problems keep recurring? We'll also discuss WPLG Local 10's decision to split with the ABC network. Will it usher in bold new local television programming and journalism, or is it a big business risk? And we'll look at WLRN's new series, History We Call Home, 100 Years of South Florida, starting with Jupiter. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. This week, we were reminded again that after more than four decades, we still have a problem to reckon with out on the western Everglades fringe of Miami-Dade County, the overcrowded Federal Chrome Detention Center for migrants. A USA Today report points out two migrant deaths at Chrome in the past 2 months, but also interviews with immigrant women who said they were treated like animals there. New viral video from inside the lockup also raises protests about its allegedly inhumane conditions. The Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, which runs Chrome, said in a statement that it is committed to providing a, quote, humane environment for the migrants in custody, who in actuality are not criminals. But President Trump's sweeping crusade to arrest and deport undocumented migrants may be pushing Chrome's capacity to a breaking point. Either way, this kind of Chrome controversy is hardly new, which of course begs the question, why can't its problems be fixed? We'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is WLRN investigative reporter Danny Rivero, who also produced the station's award-winning podcast, Detention by Design, that examines the origins of sites like Chrome. Also with us is Sui Chung. She's executive director of the nonprofit Americans for Immigrant Justice in Miami, which keeps a close eye on Chrome. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us, Tim.
Thank you.
I want to take folks back to the Chrome Detention Center's origins, to the early 1980s, in response to the Mariel boat lift that brought 125,000 Cuban migrants to Miami. Danny Rivero, you and I spoke this week with Brianna Nofil, who teaches history at the College of William and Mary in Virginia. She's published a book titled The Migrant's Jail, An American History of Mass Incarceration, and Chrome is one of her focuses. Here's what she said about its less than auspicious beginnings.
Chrome is an absolute catastrophe from its earliest incarnations. Within months of it opening, it's an incredibly rushed job. If you've been out there, you can get a sense of it is truly in the Everglades, right? It is what is once a former missile testing site. And within months of its opening, like the Miami Health Department declares it not fit for human habitation because there is open sewage, there is contaminated water, there is just a million rats everywhere. And they are housing thousands of people there.
So, Danny, is it correct to say this facility almost had a curse on it from the start? And if so, why?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's not had the best reputation from the beginning, not just because people didn't want to be there, but because of the conditions. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is because this is not a place that was planned.
It was a hurried job.
Yeah. It was a hurried job. The federal government, initially under Jimmy Carter, decided to create this detention center or campsite there just because it was federal property. They owned it. Mm-hmm. And it was a missile testing site. And they said, well, you know, we have this land. It's way out there in the middle of nowhere in the Everglades. You know, nobody lives out there. Let's just do it here. And it was just built up very quickly. And it was kind of one of those things that once it was built, once they created it, there it is. And there's issues with it that are ongoing, and there's resistance to fixing it because it's kind of already there. It was just rushed, and yeah. Now we deal with it. And there's been issues.
But four and a half decades later, that's still the attitude?
I mean, back I was just looking at clips. Back in the early 80s, I mean, there was tons of heat in Washington about this site.
Yeah.
It used to be exclusively Haitian migrants that were held there.
Right.
Rudy Giuliani, who was a top official at the DOJ back then, actually came down here because he was facing heat that it was a concentration camp. And the Congressional Black Caucus was calling for its closure. Jesse Jackson came down. I mean, it's been a very, very big deal, and not in a good way, ever since it began.
Sui Chung, from an immigration attorney's perspective, what is it about Chrome and the way it was conceived and brought online that has made it such a controversial migrant detention center over these past 4.5 decades?
So this is, Chrome has been at issue for a very long time. We can look back to a lot of reports that have been done in the past and complaints. I think what we're facing right now is almost unprecedented in terms of the overcrowding and the reports we're receiving from out of the facility. But dating back since 1996, Americans for Immigrant Justice, at that time, Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center, did a deep report on Chrome and the neglect and the treatment, the poor treatment of immigrants at that time. Of deeper investigation and look was in 1999 and 2000, allegations of sexual abuse against women. Women have not been housed at Chrome for many decades, and now we're seeing women have been placed at Chrome once again.
Once again, yeah.
This is deeply concerning to us. The community was not notified. We're hearing about women being placed there, and we don't know what the conditions are for women. And given Chrome's horrific history and the history of medical neglect, sexual abuse, and the poor conditions, this is really alarming.
Danny Rivera, let's fast forward to the most recent Chrome controversies featured in news reports like this week's USA Today story that I mentioned. The January death of a 29-year-old Honduran migrant detainee, Henry Guillen Ruiz, and last month's death of detainee Maxim Chernyak, a Ukrainian migrant here on humanitarian parole, as well as complaints about allegedly unhealthy, if not unsafe, conditions for women detainees there, as Sui Chung just mentioned, and that viral TikTok video I mentioned earlier showing us Chrome's serious overcrowdedness. What sort of Chrome pattern does all of this reflect for you?
You know, at this moment, particularly with the return of women to the facility, it really illustrates that the federal government doesn't have the infrastructure that it needs to do the things it says it needs to do. Right, the Trump administration, like it or do not like it, they have an agenda of mass deportation.
Yeah.
And they need infrastructure for that. They really need it, and they don't have it. Is the issue? So they're really maximizing and pushing, maybe, you know, past the breaking point, some of the infrastructure that they have.
But is it just an infrastructure void we're talking about, or an oversight void that we're also talking about involved here?
I mean, in reality, something of both. But even oversight takes time. So the oversight would typically follow something like the reports of gross, you know, negligence in specific cases, or like massive overcrowding. Mm-hmm. Oversight comes on the back end, but in the short term, you know, and people have known this for many years, ever since the first Trump term. It was, where are you going to put all these people? Where is the infrastructure for it? Yeah. And there's, you know, it's part of the reason why there's an increased reliance on county jails and things in other, you know, areas and far-flung places.
Yeah,
but the resources that the federal government owns, they're maximizing it.
Yeah, and I want to get to that a little later. But Sui Chung, I remember these problems seemed especially acute during the COVID pandemic, when organizations like yours, Americans for Immigrant Justice, filed lawsuits against Chrome and the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, to fix them. And judges, as I recall, ruled in your favor. But it would seem that these frequent legal actions don't result in long-term improvement. What more needs to be done to genuinely reform this detention facility?
So I just want to go back to what Danny was mentioning and what you were mentioning on oversight. 1 week ago, the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties and the Ombudsman for Detention, those oversight offices were done away with. They're gone. So even these mechanisms that are there to try to protect or to investigate situations, they've been undone by the current administration. So when you ask what can we do, what more can be done, we are progressing to doing more undoing as opposed to a progression towards a better system of oversight, review, and something different. I want to state that we're at 50,000, almost 50,000 individuals, detained across the country right now. And it isn't what is being pushed out. There is no orderly process. Under the Biden administration, we had something called prosecutorial discretion. That is that case by case individuals are looked at. Individuals have been here a long time, don't have a criminal history, have U.S. citizen children, married to a U.S. citizen, and in the process of a pathway to final resolution to their matter. Right now, that is not what is happening. The prosecutorial discretion memo and procedures, where we are focusing our efforts on the most dangerous individuals, that is not what we're focused on right now. It is if an individual has an immigration violation of some sort, and ICE comes across them, they will be arrested. So these sweeps and these arrests are targeting individuals that have a pathway for resolution and have a lot of equity in this country and are contributing to our country in a large way. And they're the ones who are suffering right now at Chrome. Go ahead.
No, I was we should also mention that there was another recent migrant detainee death in a facility in Arizona as well. We do have problems beyond Chrome. Danny Rivera, let me ask you that same question. What is the deeper fix for the Chrome Detention Center, if there actually is one?
Right. I mean, prickly question. I mean, some advocates certainly would call for the closure, and they have called for the closure of Chrome ever since the 1980s. Probably not going to happen with this administration. But there are things at the state level and the local level that are happening. Like last month in Florida, the legislature passed a bill, an immigration bill, and part of that, it's actually due around now, but I haven't seen it. The state prison system has to come up with a list of how many open beds they have to assist with detention. And also county jail facilities are going to have to kind of present a general number of how many beds they have to assist with detention, presumably
To pick up the slack.
to pick up some of the slack or to relieve some of the overcrowding.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Danny Rivero and Sui Chung of Americans for Immigrant Justice about the latest deaths and other controversies at the Chrome Migrant Detention Center and how to fix the long-standing problems there. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Sui Chung, as we've mentioned, the big specter hanging over Chrome now is the potential for vastly more overcrowding and vastly worse deterioration of conditions there due to President Trump's sweeping campaign to arrest and deport thousands, if not millions, of undocumented migrants. I want to bring in again William and Mary's Brianna Nofill, the author of the new book, The Migrant's Jail, who sort of looks ahead here.
We know this administration has incredibly ambitious plans for how many people it wants to deport, and we know they do not have the infrastructure for this, right? That is why they are looking at Guantanamo. That is why they are sort of spitballing these ideas about if you could detain people offshore or overseas. So I think what we are going to see is the existing detention facilities pushed to the breaking point, but I also think jails are going to be really important. We know that they are already talking about what standard of jail can hold people for the Immigration Service.
So, Sui, again, that point that the infrastructure to house all the migrant detainees envisioned under President Trump's plan just isn't there. So, how much worse do you see the situation at Chrome becoming now? And do you fear that even more migrant detainees will now be transferred to conventional jails and lockups where conditions could be even worse because those facilities are for actual criminals?
I'm not sure if it could get even worse at Chrome. I encourage all of our listeners to look at the article that was just released by the Miami Herald today. The reports we're receiving from attorneys and individuals detained right now, it is people are just, they don't have beds, they don't have cots, they don't have mats, they're sleeping on cold concrete floors.
Right.
There are no toilets, 10 people in a visitation room with no toilet, 40 people in a processing room, 30 people in a room for 14. Individuals who are even being held on buses for days with an overflowing toilet and shackled, handcuffed on the bus on the Chrome property. So, not even within the facility. Freezing conditions, a lot of sickness, no medical care, no mental health care, flu is rampant, and no access to counsel. So, no ability to contact counsel.
Well, then, but Bensui, does that perhaps suggest that it would be better if they had other facilities, augmenting other facilities like county jails, et cetera, to, as Danny and I just mentioned, pick up that slack? Maybe conditions could actually be better at those facilities than what they're experiencing at Chrome.
I can't speak to that. What I can say is the road that we've traveled, it is that there is profit being made on immigrants right now, whether it is the private facilities housing immigrants, whether it is the fact that there's a tremendous technology infrastructure as well as monitoring of immigrants. This is big business for private companies
No,
right now.
and Danny, I want to, we should mention that this is a privately owned facility, Chrome. No?
No, Chrome is not privately
Oh,
owned.
it's not
It's
it's not okay.
there are some
There are
privately
some.
owned,
Okay, so
but
sorry,
not
right.
this one.
But the contractor, there's a contractor that is profiting from
Okay,
running.
that's what I was referring to. Yeah. So, but Danny, to be fair to ICE, has ICE just simply been handed an impossible situation here, or is it part of the culture that's complicit in this? What's the reality here in terms of ICE's involvement?
Yeah, I mean, certainly they're getting the directives from the top, and the directives from the top is we're going to maximize deportation, we're going to maximize holding people, we're going to make conditions rough on them and whatnot. But it is very much a gamble. And Chrome, and I will say from what this conditions sound like, it sounds like they're flirting on the edge of unrest, and there has been periods of unrest in Chrome with riots breaking out and whatnot.
And
When the
across the
conditions get
country, we saw it like in the 80s in New Orleans, right?
here
In Louisiana.
in Chrome in the 80s, there were several riots, and people broke out of it. I mean, they had to send in the National Guard. This, if the conditions get so bad for a drawn out period of time, something happens. And there, I'm not saying that that's going to happen. I'm just saying things cannot be so bad for so long, and you expect nothing will happen.
So, Yicheng, finally, I want to play one last remark here from Brianna Nofill that speaks to this country's larger immigration atmosphere today that helps lead to these problems, perhaps.
The equating of irregular migration with a criminal act is going to shape the kind of conditions that people are held in. And I think that has, for a lot of people, helped to justify that they deserve the same conditions as criminals deserve.
So over the years, Sui, but especially in the Trump years, Americans have been more and more convinced to consider illegal immigration almost on par with like violent felonies. Has that made it easier for the feds to get away with problems like Chrome's? And if so, how do we change that culture? If you could comment on that in just the last 30 seconds we have.
I want to remind the listeners that we are from an immigrant history. All of us, unless you were brought here through the atrocities of slavery or you were a Native American here, we are all immigrants. And getting back to those stories and those celebrations and that success is really, really important right now. The way that the media has been focused on talking about immigrants as criminals is absolutely not true. The studies have shown over and over that immigrants have a lower rate of criminality, and the extent that immigrants are paying into our taxes and supporting our economy, employing people, building businesses. We have to remember what the celebration of immigrants are in this country and turn the narrative.
Sui Chung is Executive Director of Americans for Immigrant Justice. Danny Rivero is WLRN's investigative reporter. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, Channel 10 divorces ABC. Is that good telenews for South Florida? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. WPLG Channel 10 TV is a respected institution here, especially Channel 10 News. Names like Glenna Milberg and Michael Putney have long been part of South Florida's daily discussion. And so the recent news about Channel 10 is now a big part of that discussion, as WPLG has announced it will soon sever its affiliate ties with the Disney-owned ABC network. WPLG President and CEO Burt Medina called it a financial decision. The station's deal with ABC simply wasn't that great anymore. But is it also a risky decision for WPLG? Or is it a chance, as Medina and station celebrities like Glenna Milberg insist, for Channel 10 to pioneer a new local television programming landscape here, especially for local TV news journalism? In fact, we just received an email from WPLG announcing a, quote, massive news expansion there. Will the station's loss of hit ABC shows like Abbott Elementary and the Oscars, though, bleed it of viewers, or does unshackling from the network give it a chance to become a more engaged and engaging local force on the small screen in the age of streaming and social media? What do you think? Give us a call at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Steve Bosquet is opinion editor and columnist for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel and, as it turns out, a former WPLG reporter back in the day. He wrote a piece for the Sun-Sentinel this week headlined, "Losing ABC Can Be a Big Win for WPLG Viewers," and he joins me now to explain why. Steve, always great to have you on.
Thanks very much, Tim. Good to be here.
Before I get to the argument of your Sun Sentinel article, I want to remind our listeners of the rich history Channel 10 has had in South Florida. Tell us a bit about that, Steve, including the nation's run-in, for example, with Richard Nixon during Watergate. What was it like working for the station back in the days guys like you and I were young cub reporters?
We had a great staff. We had the corporate backing of the Washington Post and you know, it was one of four post-Newsweek stations in America.
Right.
And they're building a great news operation in what is arguably the greatest news town in America. Certainly it was in the 1980s when I worked there. Channel 10 in Miami was a pioneer with cameras in the courtroom in Florida, which set the standard for other states. We had an investigative reporting unit. We had our own news helicopter. It was just a great place. It's where I served my journalistic apprenticeship in this state, frankly.
Yeah.
I came down here from New England in 1981 and knew nothing about the state. And it was a great experience.
And that Washington Post connection you just mentioned was the reason why Richard Nixon kind of went after Channel 10 to get at the Graham family, right?
He did, yes. This was certainly the crown jewel of the Post Newsweek broadcasting operation.
Yeah. And so walk us through why WPLG and its CEO, Burt Medina, decided that continuing an ABC network affiliate tie just didn't make business sense anymore. I mean, the decision seems to say a lot about the dramatically changing TV and media landscape today, especially when we talk about new platforms like streaming, right?
Right. You know, I'm not really an expert on the business side of the broadcasting industry, but I think I understand it well enough to tell you this, that without affiliate stations, there is no network.
Yeah.
ABC doesn't, ABC has to buy and cultivate relationships with cities all over the country. And believe me, the Miami-Fort Lauderdale market is a highly lucrative market for any network.
Yeah.
The example that Bert Medina used, that I used in my column, was the Oscars, the Academy Awards. That's one of the biggest entertainment draws all year for the ABC network. And they realized that while they're paying a handsome fee to carry the Oscars on Channel 10 in the over-the-air station they have, people are watching the Oscars on their phone and on their laptops.
Right.
So why is Channel 10 having to pay so much money for something people can get for free?
Right. And so that all factored in. And we should mention that today's owner of WPLG is Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway. And they, from what I understand, wholeheartedly supported Medina's and WPLG's decision to break with ABC, right?
That's correct. Yes, they did. And okay. As I said in print in the Sun Sentinel, this is a gutsy move because this is the local station walking out on the network. Is right. What this is.
Now, before we get to what you feel are the upsides of this move by WPLG, let's first look at the downsides, starting with ABC programming and audience that the station stands to lose by breaking with the network. How significant is that, Steve?
I think it's pretty significant. I think that, they're losing shows like Grey's Anatomy. And for those viewers who like to watch George Stephanopoulos on Sunday morning, that's gone. Good Morning America is no longer on Channel 10. They're facing a massive loss of programming.
And let's remind folks where a lot of that ABC programming will now be moving to on the South Florida airwaves.
Right. It's moving over to a sub-channel of Channel 7, WSVN, which is a Fox station. And, Fox is number one in many day parts in the ratings. So we read constantly. So there's no incentive for WSVN to drop its Fox network affiliation. Mm-hmm. I think the big question here is how committed Channel 10 is going to be to serious substantive news and public affairs programming.
Right. And then this sort of affiliate network divorce is not unprecedented here, though, right? I mean, you cite in your article the example of Channel 4 in Jacksonville about 20 years ago. How has this sort of thing played out in the past?
Well, the only example I know well and know personally is WJXT in Jacksonville, which has calls itself the local station, accent on the word the. And I've been in Jacksonville in covering hurricanes in this state. And they become the best analogy I can give you, and it's not a perfect analogy, is what Channel 10 appears to be doing. It's a local version of CNN.
Right.
Is the best analogy I can give.
Okay. So that brings me then to the upsides you see from Local 10 going on its own, independent, sans network. In your article, you assert that WPLG's break with ABC is, quote, a historic moment for South Florida to have what this region richly deserves, a full-time local news operation. So what exactly do you mean that by that, Steve, aside from just being a local CNN?
What I mean is that Channel 10 has to completely unshackle itself from all the restrictions of being a network affiliate. They can, if they want to, when some really big story is happening, they will carry it live. They'll carry it live for an hour. Mm-hmm. They can expand their signature public affairs show. I think the best show of its kind in the state is This Week in South Florida. On Sunday mornings, which is a really substantive. I cover Tallahassee a lot, as you know, and anybody in Tallahassee who has something important to say wants to be on that program in Miami.
No, I would agree. You and I both have been guests on that show.
That's right.
And I can attest to that. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Steve Busquet, about WPLG Channel 10 TV's divorce from the ABC network and what it portends for local television programming here, especially local TV news journalism. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. So, Steve, going back to what you were just saying about how this creates a historic moment for South Florida, I want to play here the remarks of WPLG's president and CEO Bert Medina about why he thinks this is going to take TV here more confidently into the future.
Our business model is changing. It's like a car that you're having maintenance on and the wheels are coming off. And you don't even realize it because you're going 65 miles an hour. No one wants to do change. But change can be thrilling and exciting. And what is happening to Local 10 is the next phase of broadcast television. Local broadcasters. We will make history and we will set the model for what television stations in the 21st century will look like.
Steve, what is he really referring to there when he says this move is about moving toward what local TV in the 21st century will look like?
I think it means eventually that the model of the 6 o'clock news, where you basically have to rearrange your life to sit down and watch a newscast, is going out the window. It's over. And everything is going to be streaming services and digital. And, you know, you don't have to watch that This Week in South Florida program at 10 o'clock in the morning on Sunday or whenever it is. Mm-hmm. You can watch it whenever you feel like it.
They
see that day coming. You know, this is partly driven by demographics and by the ever-changing population and the dynamics of a place as dynamic as South Florida is.
Why does South Florida need this sort of local TV resource shift that's envisioned here to increase news and journalism, like, as you said, like a local version of CNN, away from what you call in your article the more escapist programming that tends to fill the docket on local TV from day to day, including, as you say, the local TV news inclination toward shootings and car crashes?
Right. That was part of the reason, frankly, why I decided to move my career from broadcasting to print journalism. It was the obsession with plane crashes, mayhem, which is easy and cheap to cover.
If it bleeds, it leads.
That's right. And what I would say is, so this is a golden opportunity, but it's a big challenge for WPLG because they have to build on the great foundation they have and do quality news programming. People want to find out that Channel 10 has the opportunity in a broadcasting platform to explain to people in great detail why you can't buy a house in South Florida, why property insurance is so expensive in South Florida, the demographic changes we talked about Broward becoming much more of a Caribbean community, for example. It's unlimited, the opportunities they have here.
Now, Steve, as we mentioned, you and I have often in the past been guests on Local 10's Sunday news talk show This Week in South Florida, and I think you and I can both attest to the fact that the news organization there is stellar. What then do you see happening now to make this post-network transformation at WPLG happen? As I mentioned, they just sent us an email saying they are undergoing now a massive news expansion. What do you see being contained in that massive expansion?
Yeah, I saw the same email you just described, Tim. It means a lot more reporters in a lot more places, I hope, again, covering substantive stuff.
And again, having the resources to do that because they are pulling away from this deal with ABC.
Right. And Bert Medina is right, as he said in that news release. And I know people who've been in the business. Layoffs at stations in markets like Boston and Chicago and places like that. And here you've got a station in Miami that's ramping up their staff enormously. They're going to get hundreds, if not thousands, of applications from experienced reporters. Now, those people don't know their way around Broward County or Northeast Dade, but they'll learn it. They can learn it. We all did.
Right, as we all did when we were, as you said, Cub reporters. But, you know, finally, Steve, here, we should mention, too, that some of the TV fare Local 10 viewers do enjoy will still be there, like Jeopardy, for example, because it's syndicated and not network. Still, right. Steve, for all the forward-looking benefits of this WPLG divorce that you've laid out here, will the station retain enough of the entertainment content to keep enough viewers' eyes on Channel 10 to see them through this transformation, this transition, which is, let's face it, is a risky move into the telefuture?
Yeah, I this is a great question that I frankly don't have the answer to. In other words, if they're not programming news at 8 o'clock at night,
right,
when people are in an entertainment viewing mode, what are they
right
showing?
If my wife isn't saying to her, because she's a teacher and she's a huge fan of Abbott Elementary, for example, if she's not thinking, well, I'm going to be watching Abbott at this time and so I should stay on Channel 10 before that, is that a valid effect?
I think it is for a while, but again, I think that you know, I've got two grown kids. My younger son has no, and his wife have no interest, none, in cable television or in over-the-air television.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they watch is on Hulu. It's on a streaming service. It's all, you know, it's all personal choices they make for things they want to watch. And so I think that's where we're going. If I were Channel 10, I would greatly find ways to ramp up their coverage of sports. I see Florida and South Florida in particular as it's a sports crazy community.
Yep.
So take full advantage of that.
Reminder that we've got the World Cup coming up next year, right?
Absolutely. So that's a form of entertainment. I realize it's mm-hmm. not Abbott Elementary, but right. but they're going to have to find very ingenious ways. They're going to be on August 4th, I think is the date. They're going to throw a switch somewhere, mm-hmm. and Channel 10 is going to have massive amounts of airtime to fill.
Right.
And so it's going to be interesting to watch. It really is.
Well, we'll stay tuned. Steve Busquet is opinion editor and columnist at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Steve, many thanks as always.
Okay. Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it.
Still to come, Jupiter and a host of other South Florida cities turns 100. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. This week, WLRN News started a new series, History We Call Home, 100 Years of South Florida. In it, we commemorate the centennials of several South Florida cities that were founded back in 1925 and 26 during the epic Florida land boom of the early 20th century. Almost a dozen cities in Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade counties are turning 100, from Coral Gables to Hollywood to Jupiter. Jupiter, in fact, is where the History We Call Home series starts. And it's an especially interesting place to start, given the city's origins as a life-saving station to save shipwrecked sailors in the 19th century, an effort that would help create the modern Coast Guard. Jupiter was also a key lookout point to monitor the Spanish fleet during the Spanish-American War of 1898. When the city incorporated in 1925, it still had fewer than 100 voters. A century later, its population is 61,000. Do you have any good stories to share about Jupiter's history or that great Florida land boom of the 1920s? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to talk about that important Jupiter journey is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus. Wilkin, how are you up there?
Hey, Tim. All is well.
So, Jupiter was incorporated on February 9th, 1925, but like you, I have to admit what really struck me was the 19th century history of the place and its role as the Jupiter Inlet Life-Saving Station. I did not know that Jupiter played such an important part in Florida's maritime history. I also didn't know there were so many shipwrecks there. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, Tim, I mean, let's just say there were no taxis or ride-sharing car companies back then, but the Jupiter Inlet Life-Saving Station was set up in 1885 as part of an early nationwide effort to rescue shipwrecked sailors and basically protect lives along the dangerous U.S. coast. And so the life-saving station in Jupiter was one of the first rescue stations in Florida. And so ships were obviously one of the primary modes of transportation. And so people back then often navigated through unexpected storms and shallow waters. So the station's crew, who were known as surfmen, were essentially brave men who really had to go above and beyond to get people to safety, house them, and help sailors go on their way.
Now, this was actually part of a network of life-saving stations along Florida's Atlantic coast that I also did not really know anything about until I heard your report.
Yeah, and, you know, likewise, I was raised in Palm Beach County, and I had no idea that the life-saving stations, specifically what was called Houses of Refuge, mm-hmm. which, as you said, were spread out from Miami Beach all the way up to Flagler Beach in the northern part of the state. And so the U.S. Life Saving Station, or I'm sorry, the U.S. Life Saving Service built 10 houses of refuge, which were often run by contractors and their families who lived on site. And so the Jupiter Station, which was part of the U.S. Life Saving Service, was part of this network until it closed.
Well, yeah, it closed. What then happened to the Jupiter Life Saving Station after it did close in 1896, I think you mentioned? Is any of it still around?
Yeah, I mean, I wish it was still around. I would have taken some lovely pictures of it. Unfortunately, it isn't around anymore. But there is a historical marker on the land itself called Carlin Park, which is named after Captain Carlin. And it honors the station's pioneering legacy and all of the people who worked there. And so after it closed, the life-saving station's functions were actually absorbed by the nearby Stewart Station. And folks in Miami, if you don't know where Stewart is, it's about an hour north of
Of
Jupiter.
Jupiter, right.
Yeah. And that particular station is known as the Gilbert's Bar House of Refuge. And I forgot to ask why it's called Gilbert. I'll follow up on that some other time. Yeah, so the Jupiter building was eventually repurposed by the U.S. government of war, or for purposes of war.
Yeah.
But the Gilbert Bar House of Refuge in Stewart is still there.
Yeah, and this sort of makes a question pop into my head all of a sudden, Wilkin. If it hadn't been for all the shipwrecks that happened along Florida's coast, would we have even seen any kind of populating of the Florida coast, back in those days? Would there have been any
Right.
reason for people to live there and create communities?
I mean, you need referees, right, on the beach is what I called it during my interview with Josh Litter, the historian there.
Right.
And so obviously a lot of folks didn't realize that this led to the creation of the U.S. Coast Guard.
Yes, and that was my next question. Tell us about that.
So the story goes beyond brave surfmen in our community. Their efforts are essentially connected to a broader national contribution because in 1915, the Life Saving Service, the U.S. agency that managed these stations, merged with the Revenue Cutter Service, a customs enforcement agency. And you combine those two, exactly. Yeah, you combine those two agencies, that essentially led to the U.S. Coast Guard, which helped the military streamline their efforts.
Wow. And then move ahead then to the turn of the 20th century, and it turns out Jupiter played another really important historical role, this time as a prime lookout for the Spanish naval fleet during the Spanish-American War of 1898. Tell us about that too.
It got much much more serious than just random ships crashing on shore, right?
Yeah.
And so the Jupiter Life Saving Station was closing. The U.S. military set up what's called the Coastal Signal Service, which used existing stations like the Jupiter Station to track enemy ships, Tim, during the Spanish-American War of 1898. And so it was basically repurposed as a lookout with naval reserve members who used all of the tools like spy glasses and telegraphs to spot threats. And it actually goes beyond that. It actually laid the groundwork for the military lookout networks around World War I and World War II.
Yeah, no. And that's important because, like in World War II, for example, monitoring the Florida Straits was really important because a lot of German ships would be going through there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have a history of German ships that actually approach U.S. borders here, specifically in Florida. And so, yeah.
So, Wilkin, how did all of that strategic activity then come to contribute to the identity of the city of Jupiter today, a place that admittedly a lot of folks tend to think of as one of those relaxed communities on Florida's Gold Coast?
Yeah, I wrestled with this question when I was reporting the story. And when I spoke with historians and started looking at some of the archives and photos, I'm like, oh, this makes perfect sense. Because even for locals, Jupiter is known for its small town charm. But when you look at the lead photo of my article, it's basically a group photo on the beach of Captain Charles Carlin, who was the keeper of the Jupiter Inlet Life Saving Station, of the surfmen and women who were family members. So it wasn't just men who were out there. It was just a whole group of people who were actually stationed on site at this life-saving station, having children, getting married. And so the photo of early settlers served as a symbol of how Jupiter's growth is forever tied to its maritime roots and
Right.
obviously, little-known military contributions.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Paget. I'm talking with WLRN's Wilkin Brutus about the 100th anniversary of Jupiter, the city, not the planet. Part of our new WLRN series, History We Call Home, 100 Years of South Florida. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So moving into the 20th century, Wilkin, in spite of that rich 19th century history we were just talking about, Jupiter still doesn't seem to see a lot of population growth. You mentioned in your report that by the 1920s, there were still fewer than 100 voters there. But then comes the Great Florida Land Boom. How did that transform Jupiter?
Yeah, the Great Florida Land Boom of the 1920s. So that actually brought rapid infrastructure growth to Jupiter, including new roads, street lighting on Dixie Highway, more importantly, a water supply system, and of course, its incorporation as a town in 1925, 5 years later. And so the city went from 100 people or so to 61,000 today. Yeah. And it's gradually growing. I think the city of West Palm Beach, which is our largest city in Palm Beach County, is growing at a faster pace. But Jupiter is gradually growing, but it's around 61,000 today.
How then has Jupiter tried to keep that rich coastal history it has alive today, especially the efforts of local historians like Josh Liller, as you mentioned, you spoke with, who conveys a lot of rich context in your report?
Yeah, a lot of rich context, a lot of passion in his heart. When I arrived at the Jupiter Inlet Lighthouse and Museum to speak with Josh Liller, he made it clear that even though the station is no longer there, and I was quite disappointed because, of course, I'm also learning as I'm reporting at that time.
Sure.
The historical marker at Carlin Park essentially marks the spot where it once stood. And so it's these small town efforts that not only honors the town's legacy, but connect the present with the past, and that people can still visit Gilbert's Bar House of Refuge in Stewart, which keeps the history alive. And so when you connect these two experiences with Stewart and Jupiter, you still have a rich context for where the city has been and where it's going.
In fact, I want to end here by playing a little bit of what Josh Liller shared with you about the importance of this work for communities like Jupiter.
People come here to Florida, especially South Florida, oftentimes from out of state. They're not familiar with Florida's past. Oftentimes they don't realize Florida really had any past before Disney and air conditioning. And so it's important for organizations like our Historical Society to make people aware of all ages that we have a past here from early Native Americans, the pioneers, the military, oftentimes doing roles that people don't always think about.
Well, I feel like that's something we can't stress enough in Florida, and especially South Florida, that history matters. What do you think folks here can learn in that regard from what places like Jupiter are doing, Wilkin? You know, why does that make reporting like our History We Call Home series so important?
Yeah, it's extremely important. He mentioned Native Americans. He mentioned the lesser-known Black community in Jupiter, which I was obviously unaware of as well. And so reporting like our History We Call Home, our archives our past and present. It archives it. Right. And it makes us feel much closer to local history and away from surface level views of Florida. We're much larger, culturally larger, and historically important than Florida man stereotypes.
Right. So, no, and it's nice here that to end here, we do have a caller from Jupiter, Mary Therese. And she'd like to weigh in on this aspect of Jupiter's history as well. Mary Therese, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hi, thank you. This is so great to talk to you about Jupiter's history. I'm president of the Loxahatchee Guild. We're a historic preservation group, and we've been around since 1981. And we have saved buildings that reflect the history of Jupiter, including the Tyndall Pioneer House. We work with the lighthouse. And one thing that we did was save the train station. It had been carried up to Cuesta and was going to be demolished. And somebody from our local paper called me and said, "Hey, did you know this was going to be destroyed?" And I said, "Oh my gosh, this is history." So I got the town of Jupiter to agree to work with us. And they saved it, and it's now in the Sawfish Bay Park.
Well, thank you, Mary. Thank you, Mary Therese. I'm sorry for time. We have to end it there. Wilkin Brutus is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter. Wilkin, thanks as always, sir.
Tim, thank you, sir.
You can find the History We Call Home series at WLRN.org, and we want to give a shout-out to the series' project manager, WLRN's government accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos. Finally on the Roundup, WLRN's Christine DiMatte tells us the New World Symphony in Miami Beach is saying a poignant farewell to the conductor affectionately known as MTT.
3 years ago, Michael Tilson Thomas announced that he was stepping down as artistic director of the New World Symphony, the orchestral academy he co-founded. Months earlier, he had been diagnosed with a particularly aggressive form of brain cancer. Last month, 80-year-old Tilson Thomas announced that the illness would force him to scale back his performances. This weekend, he returns to Miami Beach to lead his last two concerts with the orchestra. Howard Herring is president and CEO of the New World Symphony. He says Tilson Thomas's conducting style allows musicians to be themselves.
If you watch his gestures, it's counter to what most people understand as a conductor. He's not conducting, he's inviting, and the result is glorious.
The third and last piece on this weekend's program is Beethoven's Fifth, the same piece that the New World Symphony played at the end of its inaugural concert in 1988. I'm Christine DiMattei in Miami.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.